Welcome to Trilawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glowski, and I'm your host for this podcast. We're going to talk to some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. We're going to talk to civil lawyers, criminal lawyers, jury consultants, and others that I think will have some interesting stories that are both entertaining and insightful. My goal here is to give you a view inside the hearts and the minds and the souls of great trial lawyers. We're not going to talk about the law, but I guarantee you that you'll learn a lot about trial through the stories that you're going to hear from our great guests. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. Let's get started. Welcome to Trial Lawyer Talk. This is Scott Glowski, and I'm very, very thankful that today we have a phenomenal trial lawyer as our guest, Michael Callahan from Houston, Texas, who is one of the most genuine, authentic, and caring people I know. Michael has had tremendous success in very, very difficult jurisdictions in Texas, getting justice for people who have been severely injured in all kinds of personal injury cases. Michael, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, Scott, thank you for having me, and I'm honored to be here and quite frankly, flattered by those very kind words that you just said.
Michael, can you tell me about a case that profoundly changed you as a lawyer or as a person?
Well, there are a number of cases that come to mind, but I think that the one that stands out the most is the Lumpkins case, and just some brief facts about the case. I was honored to represent a 27-year-old woman who, while on the job, was driving a 15-passenger van with about, I think she had seven elderly, disabled patients in her van, and she's traveling on one of the freeways in Houston. And has a blowout of one of her tires, and while trying to get off the road, she was steering towards one of the exits. A fully loaded cement truck came over an overpass, and the driver wasn't paying attention, and crashed into the back of the van at about 55 or 60 miles an hour. And essentially crushed it in half and pushed it about 100 yards down the freeway before it finally came to a stop. And all of her passengers were killed. And Aries, who was a single mother at the time, 27 years old, it shattered certain levels in her spine, and she's now paraplegic. There were a lot of very challenging issues in the case. The deck was very much stacked against her for a number of reasons, and it was a fight. It was a slog for about, I was hired, and we worked up the case, and within 2 years we went to trial on the case and got a verdict on it.
Michael, you said the deck was really stacked against her.
Right. The deck was very much stacked against her.
Tell me about that.
Gosh, where do I start? first of all, the company she was working for had a lot of problems. Her boyfriend actually owned the company, and he had a couple of vans that were in less than stellar condition. They weren't maintained properly, and the van that she was driving that day. And what she would do, she would drive around to the homes where these people lived, these elderly disabled folks, and pick them up, and then take them out to a daycare facility where they would undergo rehabilitation, psychological counseling, and that kind of thing. And she would stay with them throughout the day. And then at the end of the day, she would transport them back to their respective homes. And they were, there was a house keeper there in the sense that someone who would make the meals and take care of these folks, and assisted living homes is what they were. So Ari's boyfriend had a couple of vans, and he hired her to drive one of the vans. And the vans were in just horrible condition. I think the van she was in that day had, we were in Texas, and it had Virginia license plates on it, and that's not such a bad thing in and of itself. But, expired license plates, expired registration sticker, about a three-year past expired inspection sticker. Tape over the tail lights. I think it was missing some like the rear view mirror, and it was just in terrible condition and really should not have been on the road. But she was a single mother and doing the best she could, and this is the job she had, and that was the equipment that she was given to do the work, and so she did the best she could.
What other challenges were there in her case, besides the fact that the van was not in let's just say ideal condition?
And also the tires were essentially bald, and one of the tires blew out. And just before this crash happened, one of the tires went flat, and so she took it to a small mom and pop shop. Maybe 30 minutes before this crash happened, where they supposedly changed out her tire and put another tire on it that was not in the best condition, and that was the tire that ended up blowing out. On top of that, the vehicle that hit her was a fully loaded cement truck owned by a company called Cemex, which is it was at the time, and I think it still is, the largest cement company in North America and one of the largest in the world. It's based out of Mexico. And Cemex has a very big presence in Houston, Texas. And, quite frankly, they do a lot for the community, especially the, in my view, the policing community, and have got a very good relationship with the local police force there. So after this crash, within a few minutes, Cemex, the police come out to the scene. Within a few minutes, Cemex supervisors, including their risk manager, were out of the scene as well. Cemex brought one of its experts in accident reconstruction out to the scene, and they're taking pictures and they're taking measurements, and it's not just the impression I got. I think what very much happened is that Cemex in the local police force, they very much circled the wagons around Cemex, and the conclusion by the investigating officer was that Ari's was 100% at fault for this crash. They went out and they talked to witnesses, and in my view, coerced, it's a hard word to say, and it's a hard accusation to make, but I think they very much coerced about five or six witnesses into saying things and signing statements that turned out not to be 100% accurate.
And I understand that your client may have had some other issues that made her not quite sympathetic, let's say.
There was the main one is this. I mean, so she's, her back is broken, and they take her to the local hospital, and they're running all sorts of tests on her. And one of the tests they run, of course, is a urinalysis. The hard truth is that the urinalysis results came back, and she tested positive for what's called benzoylecognine, which is a component that when it's it's a component of cocaine. When a person ingests cocaine, the body breaks it down, and benzoylecognine is one of those residual components, and she tested positive for it, and. So we had that in the case, that she had ingested cocaine at some time before the crash. And of course, Cemex and their lawyers wanted to say she was under the influence at the time, but the urinalysis did not indicate she was under the influence. It's just that she had, within 72 hours or so before the crash on this Monday morning, that she had ingested cocaine.
So tell me the story of how this case changed you? In other words, what you did to work up this case and what impact it had on you?
Oh, goodness. Where to start? I remember when I first got called up to the hospital by the family, and went up and went into the ICU, and Aries was kind of in and out of consciousness, and I talked to her, and it was just hard to see her there for that first time. I mean, it's just a beautiful, beautiful young lady, African American young lady, and just gorgeous. If she could stand up, she was 5'10", 5'11". She was from Southern California. That's where she grew up. And in high school, she ran track. She was on the cheerleading squad. Just a really a beautiful, physically beautiful person, and also just a beautiful soul, a very soft spoken and lovely and delicate. And in many ways, I just my heart went out to her and just fell in love with her and who she was at that moment. And at that point, she knew that she couldn't feel her legs, but I'm not sure that she knew what the ultimate diagnosis was, even though I was told what it was. And then I met her son. She had an 8-year-old son. And it just it broke my heart. It was a very sad story. And she was a single mother, so it was just the two of them. And then we started investigating, got the police report, and saw that the officers, and this lead officer, he heads up the Accident Reconstruction Division at HPD, the Houston Police Department at the time. And he had been involved in a number of high-profile accident investigations and reconstructions, one of which was a lady, I think a female dentist, down in Clear Lake, Texas, who caught her husband cheating one time, and so she decided to run him over and ended up running him over multiple times. And I shouldn't make light of it, and ended up killing him. And she went to trial, and he was the key witness that put her behind bars. And he was involved in a number of other high-profile accident reconstructions. And so he was a formidable witness, and he was against us. So really, the first 6 months or so, my focus was on getting to know Aries and just doing whatever I could for her, and then focusing on the liability part of the case, because that's where I thought the problem was.
Tell me about Aries.
It certainly was.
How did you get to know Aries, and what did you do for her?
I visited her at the hospital frequently while she was there, and then she was released to a rehab facility, and I would go up there and visit. Stayed in touch with her sister and other family members, and tried to help out in whatever way I could with her son. And then I remember the day that she was released from the rehab facility. And was she really ready to be released? I mean, she could have used a lot more rehab, but unfortunately, she didn't have the finances or the health insurance to continue getting the kind of rehab that I think would have helped her. I mean, it wouldn't have resulted in her walking again. She's a permanent paraplegic. I think she had about a 5 or 6 level fusion in her lumbar and thoracic spine, and you can't undo that. So she got discharged from the hospital to her apartment, and obviously couldn't work. Didn't have any health insurance. Her family couldn't do a lot to help her out financially. So, just a part of my job, as I saw it, was to care for her, not only in terms of handling the case, but I did everything I could to help, support her financially and support her son financially, while we tried to help her with the legal case. And so that involved. That involved finding an appropriate apartment for her on the first floor that had a ramp for her wheelchair, helping her with bills, And, you know, she had follow-up appointments as well, and that was very difficult because how is she supposed to get around? And we had to coordinate with the city of Houston for a wheelchair-accessible van to come around and pick her up. And needless to say, it was never on time. It was always running late, an hour late or 2 hours late. And they'd finally get to her doctor's appointment, and the doctor couldn't see her because she was late. So she'd have to reschedule. And it was just a challenge after challenge. And I spent, I don't know how many hours at her house just sitting and visiting with her and doing what I could to take care of her and to get to know her, really, and to get to know get a better sense of what she was going through, get a sense of who she was before the crash happened. And it took probably 6 or 8 months before she was ready to talk with me about what happened that day leading up to the crash.
How often would you see her in that 6 to 8 months?
I'd say throughout the time that I handled the case, I'd go out to her apartment and spend time with her at least once, and sometimes, you know, 2-3 times a month.
So how many hours do you think you spent with her throughout the case?
Oh, goodness. That's tough to estimate. A lot. Enough to get to know her very well.
Yeah, hundreds?
Figure 4 hours a month for 24 months. What is that? You know, close to 100 hours, 96 hours, and that was just to go out and visit her. But then also, many times spending a lot more time than that with her to review medical bills, to help her understand what happened that day. And, you know, of course, through the Trial Lawyers College, we learn these techniques to discover the story, doing psychodrama. And, you know, and I had a psychodramatist come down, and we worked for a couple of days with her in a big group. Kathy St. Clair came and worked with us. So those were a couple of 10-hour days. I had her at my office not that many times, because it was just easier for me to go to see her and bring a stack of medical records, bring a stack of documents, and work with her. Hundreds of hours, yes.
Tell me why this case had a profound impact on you.
Because she was such an underdog. And I saw a beautiful person, again, not just physically, but beautiful just through and through. Someone who tried to do the right thing, who struggled, was someone who was doing the best that she could, who didn't always make the best decisions, but, I mean, who does amongst us? And then this happens to her, and it just seemed like, you know, instead of people reaching out to try to help her, everyone was against her. And it just touched me. I think everybody's had that feeling before where, you don't have a chance, or someone you know doesn't stand a chance, and they're just such an underdog, and the deck is completely stacked against them. And I just, there was just something about her case and about her that I couldn't give up. So we just kept fighting. And so the thing is, the first 6 or 8 months, I was focused on the liability part of the case, which means how the crash happened.
Well, you just mentioned that the deck was stacked against her, and it seemed like she had little. Did that resonate with you personally?
Oh, yeah.
How so?
I mean, I think I can't speak for all people, but there are many times in my life that I've felt like the underdog, where people didn't believe in me, maybe, didn't think I was... Yeah, where people didn't believe in me, and I just, and you've got to go sometimes to that place in yourself where, where you've got to reach deep down inside and believe in yourself, and you really very much hit ground zero. And there's only one way to go, and that is up. And I just felt that she was at that place, and I wanted to help her. I mean, what happened was not right.
Michael, can you share with us a time in your life when you felt that way?
I suppose. And I'm not trying to blame anyone for anything, but I mean, this is just a part of our lives. We all have our experiences, and I come from a family where one of my parents is an alcoholic, he doesn't drink anymore. My father doesn't drink anymore, but he did when I was growing up, and it just creates a dynamic in the household, and it was something that was hidden, that I didn't see. I mean, there wasn't drinking out in the open, but as a kid, just instinctively, you know that something's not quite right. And you feel like you're walking on eggshells a lot. And there's just, sometimes you just, at least I just felt like I felt very alone. And, I just remembered just generally times as a kid, just, wishing I wasn't a kid anymore. I just wanted to grow up. And it's, there's just times that were painful. And I just remembered, as a kid, being in my room sometimes because getting yelled at or whatever it might be for whatever. And sometimes it was things that I didn't do, but got accused of and got blamed. And just finding a place deep inside of me that I would go to find refuge. And, I'm not looking for sympathy or anything, but I just discovered in myself, had to discover in myself at a young age, a place that I could go internally, the place of peace, a place of refuge, a place of, where in the end I'd had to believe in myself. There was no other way. It was about survival. And so, I think on some level I felt that with Aries and ultimately in working with her and doing self-discovery throughout the case, just understanding why is it that I relate to this person and how do I relate to this person, I realized that that was a big part of how I related to her and why I hung in there and why I fought and put thousands of hours and all my finances into this case that was just so incredibly difficult. She needed someone to fight for, and I'm not trying to sound like a hero or something, but she just resonated with me, and I cared about her, and I didn't want to. What am I going to do? Pack up and turn my back on her and walk away like everyone else had? I couldn't do it, and I believed in her. I knew she wasn't perfect, that she had made mistakes, but damn it, she didn't deserve what happened to her.
Well, investing so much of your time and your psyche and your energy and your money into a case that was an incredibly difficult case, how did that make you feel during that process?
Scared to death. A lot of lost sleep. Inability to sleep. Waking up in the middle of the night. Emotionally, psychologically, it's difficult. Physically, it takes a toll on one's body. I started to see a lot more gray hairs. And it's not just about me. It's about also, the toll that it took on my family, and that's something that I didn't realize during the course of it so much. I guess on some level I did, but it was only afterwards, reflecting on it, just realizing how much of a toll. It wasn't just about me. It's about the toll that it took on them, because I wasn't around, and when I was around, maybe I was there physically, but on so many different levels, I was very much somewhere else. So, you know, I'm very grateful to my wife for understanding and being supportive, and also to my daughter, who was, I guess, maybe 3 or 4 years old at the time. And I don't know if she remembers any of it. I hope hope she doesn't. Or if she does, I hope she doesn't. I hope she's not adversely affected by it. But it was a very, very challenging time.
So tell me about the days right before trial, how you were feeling in those days.
Oh, my goodness. You know, we had been set for trial a couple of times. And as frustrating as that is, I mean, in many ways, it's a gift to be set for trial multiple times, because that means you get ready for trial each time. I do. And my preparation gets better each time. I mean, I go through voir dire and opening and closing and witness direct exams and cross exams and look at medicals again and look, I mean, just review the whole thing. And so the story becomes more clear. My understanding of the case becomes better. And the story becomes tighter, and it inevitably evolves a little bit. And it becomes a stronger, more powerful story. So leading up to the time that we finally tried the case, there was a lot of anxiety, but there was also, you know, it just got to a point where, I mean, the day of the trial, I felt peace. I mean, there was a part of me, yeah, I was scared, but I felt peaceful, because I knew I was well prepared. We were well prepared, and there was no other way to go. We just had to go forward.
How did you bring her story to life in the courtroom?
I just gave her an opportunity to show who she is. You know, we started by talking about her personal background, and I mean, just immediately, just her tone of voice, so soft-spoken and so beautiful, and a little shy, a little bashful, but also very courageous. We spent some time talking about her background and about her son, and just to show the side of her, and not just the side, I mean, it's very much her, that she's a very loving, caring, thoughtful person. And then, you know, one of my concerns in the case, a big concern, was that, the defense was going to say that, I mean, she just didn't care about the people in her van, and that she was reckless, and she had, you know, illegal drugs in her system, even though, I mean, the urinalysis, what it showed was an inactive metabolite of cocaine. And inactive, what that means is that it ain't active. And we wish it wasn't there, but by gosh, it was there. But if it's inactive, that means it's not having an effect on the person at that time. You know, and this crash happened on a Monday morning. The defense, they wanted to paint her as a horrible, awful person that really didn't give a darn about the people in her van who were crushed and killed. So that was a big challenge in the case. And on one hand, before trial lawyers college, I would have just, you know, got her to talk about how much she cared about these people, and she would never do anything to harm them. And I would have, the only way I would have known was to get her to tell the jury that she cared and loved for these people. But what I've come to learn is that that's not the most compelling way to do it. So what I did is that in the courtroom, while she's up on the witness stand, of course, she's in a wheelchair. She can't come down and set the scene for me. And I wanted to set the scene, which means let's set up this van. And with other witnesses, I'll have the witness come off the witness stand, and we start setting the scene and doing a reenactment, but she couldn't do it. So I had to get up and do it, and grabbed one chair and set it in front of the jury box, and she is, you know, pointed out that this is where she was sitting. She was in her 15-passenger van. I walked off the van. We talked about what color it was, what it looked like. And then we placed the driver's seat, and she talked about that's how she, where she was sitting and what it was like sitting there. And I put her in first person, and she talked about that. And then I set up the chair next to her, and we talked about, I said, well, who was sitting here? And she said, oh, well, that was Miss Green. Well, what's Miss Green wearing? Look over at her now. What is she wearing? So I put her in present tense on the day. And so she talked about Miss Green and what she was wearing. Well, tell us a little bit about Miss Green. We'd like to get to know her. And she would tell us a little story about Miss Green. And so I went through and just one by one set up all the chairs that were in the van. And we met each and every person. There was Mr. Jones, who was about 78 years old, and he had dementia and some Alzheimer's, but he was a big guy, former football player in college. And Ari said that he was just the biggest flirt, and he would always flirt with her. Well, what do you mean by that, Ari? And she would tell us some stories about how he would flirt with her, and she would say, no, Mr. Jones, thank you so much. You're so sweet. And so they had this little relationship going on. And then there was another lady as well. I forget her name exactly, but we got to, I said, Aries, introduce us to her. What is she wearing? What does she have on her head? Well, she wears a hat. Well, tell us about that hat. Well, it's a hat. It's got like little fruit around the perimeter of it. And so we got this idea of what this hat was like. And, well, tell us a story about her. I said, well, one day, about a week before this happened, we were up at the facility, and usually Miss Brown, for instance, Miss Brown was always very cheerful and chatty, but today she just kind of sat in the corner, and she seemed so sad, and I didn't understand why. So I went over and I sat down and held her hand and said, Miss Brown, what's going on? What's on your mind? You're always so happy and cheerful. What's happened? What's going on? And she said, well, today's my birthday, and my family didn't remember, and I haven't heard from them. And so anyway, it's my birthday, and I'm just feeling a little sad and a little lonely. And so what Aries did then, she went out and bought a birthday cake and came back and had a birthday party for Miss Brown and got the whole group to celebrate Miss Brown's birthday. And it's just the way that Aries explained it. I mean, you felt like these people were in this van, in this courtroom, and we knew them. They had a face. We knew what they were wearing. We got a sense of who they were. And suddenly they were very real people. And the picture that it painted was that these weren't just, faceless names. These were real people that Aries knew and that she cared about. Instead of telling the jury, oh, she cared about them, we showed that she cared about them because she talked about how well she knew them, and she was able to tell very intimate personal stories about each one. So suddenly we had a van full of people. And then I went to, well, Aries, you're driving down Highway 249 in Houston. How fast are you going? Okay, what happens? You hear a big boom. Okay, what do you do? And we went through. She slows down, and she comes to a stop on the freeway. I said, I stopped on the freeway. Well, why'd you do that? And she said, well, I didn't know what happened. I thought the transmission fell out or the under part of the van fell out. I didn't know. So I stopped. And, well, what's traffic like? Traffic was not very bad, and there were some cars behind me, but they slowed down, and they safely passed. And what did you do next? Well, I got out of the van. You got out of the van? What do you mean? On the freeway? Well, yeah. Well, then what happened? Well, I walked over, and that's when I saw that my front left tire had blown out. And so, what'd you do then? Well, I got back in the van. And what's going on? Well, all the passengers, they're asking, what's happening? What's going on? Aries, what's happened? And Aries says, everybody just settle down. It's going to be okay. We got a flat tire. We're going to go to this exit up here, and we're going to be okay. So she puts the van in gear and starts in her lane and goes a certain distance, and she's got a flat tire, she can't go very fast, and she checks to the right and changes lanes safely, and then she checks to the right again, and as she goes to change lanes, she gets hit by the cement truck. And that's the last thing she remembered. The next thing she remembered is she wakes up, and so she talks about, she heard this big boom. And so I paused, and then there was silence. And I said, Aries, what happened next? And she said, I can't feel my legs. I said, what, Aries? She said, I can't feel my legs. Aries, I can't hear you. I can't feel my legs. And she puts her head in her hands and she just bursts out crying. And we just pause, and the jury is just, I mean, there's silence in the courtroom. You could hear a pin drop. And something I meant to point out is while she's talking about what happened leading up to the crash, I got my associate lawyer to come up. I waved to him, and we got one of our big poster boards, and we came up behind the chairs that represented the van. And as she's talking about, I changed lanes safely, and I went to change lanes again, and then boom. And when that happened, I knocked down the first row of chairs, and I knocked down the second row of chairs. And the judge says, Mr. Callahan, stop doing that. And I said, Judge, I'm so sorry. And then I go and knock down the third row of chairs, and the judge glares at me. But it was just, we recreated the crash right then and there. So you got all these rows of chairs knocked down on the floor right in front of the jury, and the only chair that's still sitting upright is Aries' chair, the driver's seat. And that's when I say, what happened next? And that's when she says, I can't feel my legs. I can't feel my legs. I can't feel my legs. And she just breaks out in tears. And it was just, I mean, you can only imagine. Again, you could hear a pin dropping on the floor. So.
Wow. During closing argument, what were you feeling and what were you communicating to the jury?
You know, inevitably I feel fear. And it's just something I can't deny. It's just about, you know, it comes up and I've just got to embrace it and find a place for it. I kind of set it off to the side and I recognize it and tell the fear it's got to sit down. Because I've got some work to do, but it keeps me energized and keeps me motivated. And you know, one thing throughout the whole case, in opening statement, I said, look, I want to tell you. I mean, I need to tell you something. That is, that Aries, she was not perfect in this case. She's made mistakes, and we're not denying it. And you're going to hear about it throughout this case, and I'm going to tell you about the mistakes that she made. But she shouldn't bear all the responsibility for what happened that day. So we're going to look at what Aries did, but we're going to also look at what C-MEX did, and what its driver did, and what it didn't do. So, you know, in closing, I talked about that. And one of the things I did was I rented a cement truck before trial and had a driver and got one of my experts to meet me on a Sunday morning early when traffic was light on this freeway. And we went out and we drove the route that this cement truck took leading up to the crash, and you could still see the gouge marks in the freeway where the impact happened. And so he started off by marking off those gouge marks, and we had a GPS device, and we also had, you know, we had a video camera. And so we're sitting in this cement truck, and we got the driver, and I'm sitting in the middle on this bench seat with the video camera. And then I've got my experts sitting on the right side of me. And we go through and we videotape what the driver saw, what he should have seen, what he could have seen. And we show this video to the jury, and it made it very clear to them that this guy, the driver, could have seen and should have seen Aries' van at least half a mile before he hit it. Yet he never... He admitted in his deposition he never saw it before he hit it. He never slowed down. He never braked. He never honked. He never swerved. He didn't do anything. So we made that very clear to the jury, and it was clear to them that this driver, who's a professional driver, wasn't paying attention to the road. And I think he might have fallen asleep. He wouldn't admit it. But what was interesting is during the course of the 2.5 week trial, the driver was sitting there and he kept dozing off during trial. And the jury saw this. So the story, I mean, I think, for me, I think the guy fell asleep behind the wheel. So, you know, we embraced the good, the bad, and the ugly on the liability part of the case. And then we went through and talked about the damages and talked about the life care plan and what it's going to cost and to help her. And this is not money for her. This is money for other people to help her. So we asked for the money for the life care plan and the past medicals. And then we talked about the human damages, about the pain, the impairment, the anguish. You know, and when she testified, I like to do it. We talk about facts, but also we talk in terms of stories. And one of the stories she told, I repeated and reenacted during the closing. And that is that I said, look, you know, you heard Aries tell us about the first time that she was able to leave her apartment. She and her son Deontay, they went to Walmart. She took her wheelchair and they went about a quarter mile down the road on the sidewalk to the Walmart. It was the first time she'd been to a Walmart since being out of the hospital, since the crash. And they go into this Walmart, you know, and she'd already talked about being in a wheelchair. It's not how people look at you. It's how they don't look at you that hurts so much. You know, and she sees how it would affect her son, who's now 9 years old. So she's in this Walmart, and she's wearing her jeans and sitting in the wheelchair, and her jeans are kind of long, and one of her jean legs, the right one, gets caught up in the wheel of her wheelchair. And then she tumbles forward. She gets pulled out of her wheelchair. The wheelchair goes rolling over, and she's laying on the floor. And I reenacted this. I sat down in a chair, and I acted. I was said, I'm Aries, and here's Deontay. And we roll ourselves into the Walmart, and then fall down and get dropped down on the ground. And I rolled down on the ground in my suit and right in front of the jury. And I was Aries at the moment, and I'd show myself trying to get up, and I just can't get up. And then I reversed out of that and became Deontay and you know, and showed me trying to help my mother up. And I'm 9 years old, and my mother, she's on the ground, and I can't get her up off the ground. And I look around, and I saw, you see these customers, and they're all standing there, and they're staring, and they don't know what to do. And I said to the jury, I mean, aren't you very much like the people in that Walmart? I mean, Aries is on the ground, and she can't get up. She can't do it herself. And her 9-year-old son, he's trying the best he can. He's trying to lift her up. And he can't do it. You know, and he needs help. They need help. And isn't this very much here today? Isn't this very much like being at the Walmart? She's here and she needs help. They need help. They can't do this on their own. And aren't you, jury, very much like the people in that Walmart? And what are you going to do? I mean, are we going to turn and walk away? Or are we going to come over and kneel down? And put our arm around Deontay? Tell him it's going to be all right and help lift Aries up and set her wheelchair right and put her back in the wheelchair so she can go on. Because she can't do it. They can't do it on their own. So, and I felt that was very powerful.
So tell me about when the verdict was read. And I'd love to hear how you were feeling in the moments before it was read, once it was read, when you looked at your client, and tell me about those feelings.
The jury deliberated for close to a total of 3 days. And when we were told that there was a verdict, everybody comes back into the courtroom. You know, and I just couldn't look over the jury, but I'm sitting next to Aries and, I'm holding her hand and she's holding my hand and we're just looking at each other. You know, how did I feel? I just felt numb. I felt like I had put everything I had on every level into this case. I had nothing left. I didn't know what was going to happen. So I look up at the judge, and he starts looking at the verdict, and he's looking through it, and I saw him. He just lost color in his face, and I didn't know what that meant. And that he went through and slowly started reading the verdict. And sure enough, the jury put some responsibility on Aries, as I said, I think you need to, and clearly she is partly at fault, and she bears responsibility for it, and she accepts that. But we're here today because C-MEX and its driver have never once accepted responsibility, and they won't unless you tell them that they need to accept it. And so that's what the verdict stated. It put responsibility on C-MEX and its driver as well, and and awarded a significant sum of money. And does it fix all their problems? No, it doesn't. But it was justice for her. And after the judge read the verdict, looked over at the jury, and they just all looked at us with just such a deep look of caring and understanding. And I looked at Aries, and she's looking at the jury as well. And she and I look at each other, and she's got tears in her eyes, and she reaches over and hugs me and just gives me the tightest, most beautiful hug I've ever gotten. And I can hear she's crying on my on my jacket, on my shoulder. And I just remember it was about, I didn't have that jacket dry cleaned for about a year and a half. I just couldn't do it, because that was the jacket that we got justice for Aries in, and it had her tears on it, her dried tears. It was interesting afterwards talking to the jury outside. We talked about a lot of things. We talked about the cocaine, and they said, look, we appreciated you addressing it and bringing it up to us and telling us how you felt about it. And quite frankly, we spent maybe 5 minutes on it, and then we decided it wasn't an issue because it was an inactive metabolite. And yeah, Aries shouldn't have been doing that, and not sure how it got in there, but in her system, but it wasn't a factor. And that was something the defense very much hung their hat on. And what was interesting is it one of the jury, I think it might have been the jury foreperson, she was about a 27-year-old woman, she said, there's something I wanted to tell you, and that is that when I was 21 years old, I was in a very bad car accident, and I broke my back, and I couldn't walk, and I was in a wheelchair for about a year. But my back, I saw the x-rays of Aries' spine, and I knew she would never walk again. Mine wasn't nearly that bad, and I had the chance to do a whole lot of rehab, and obviously I can walk today. She was up walking around like anyone else, but this is a personal story that she had. She went for a year, year and a half in her life where she was in a wheelchair, and she felt like she had no hope and would never walk again. So you never know what people's stories are or where they come from, but in the end we were honest and upfront about everything. And just put it all out there and told our story and trusted the jury, and in the end they did the right thing.
How did that make you feel?
Just so many different emotions. I'm very much relieved for her that she now has a chance, that Deontay now has a chance, her son. It doesn't fix everything. It's not like she can never not work in her life, but she could now go out and get additional medical treatment. She could She was able to, to buy a house and put some money away, and continue on with her life. It gave her a chance.
How did it make you feel about you?
My first response to that is that it wasn't about me. It was about her. But getting past that, how did it make me feel about me? It just, it just made me understand and deeper, just the power of believing in other people. It helped me understand that people, regardless of say first impressions or how they look or maybe how they vote or any of that, human beings are compassionate, caring people. If you trust them, if you give them a chance, and if you don't try to be cute or clever or play lawyer tricks, and if you just put it out there, they're going to do what's right.
Michael, what an amazing story. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. You're obviously a phenomenal lawyer, phenomenal person, and I'm so, proud and fortunate that I get to call you friend.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's an honor to have you as my friend, and I thank you for giving me the chance to share this story today.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.